agus raibh muid raibh ag an dearna cainteoir inis, Ellen Howley a thugann ó DCU. Mac léinn doctúdachta í Ellen a thosaigh siad bliain den doctúdacht, agus spéis ar le heici an sin sa litiach mar a géine agus san iliach. Agus gné spéisiú le buint sa chuid taide, sa bhéad is gwyl spéis ag ní hóan a litiach na héran ac a litiach na Caribbe chomá. So her focus is quite interesting for her thesis in that she's not just looking at Irish literature but also looking at literature of the Caribbean, and from what I understand from the little bit I've read, you're tracing some interesting what's the word I'm looking for? Cosulachti, I guess, that you're making connections, yeah. Interesting connections, yeah. Between the two.
Yeah.
So I knew to she go to Lauret Mariaul Iliach na Héirin. So I could have went to Falter of Ellen, and it's a good Cainta, an island at the centre of the world. Ireland is an island in contemporary poetry.
So thank you very much. This is kind of part of the research that I'm doing at the moment in my PhD, so still very much kind of thinking through some of these ideas. And my American spelling would make sense in a second. So, in July 2017, current Taoiseach Leo Varadkar graced the cover of Time magazine in a relaxed and approachable stance, similar to his fellow funny sock lover, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and looking away from camera at the final member of the triumvirate of young leaders, Emmanuel Macron. The interview itself is relatively uncontroversial, there's mainly softball questions. But what is most interesting for me about Varadkar's self-styling as a key player in world politics is how he locates Ireland on an international stage. Geographically, we are at the periphery of Europe, he says, but I don't see Ireland in that way. The way I see us is as an island at the centre of the world. Significantly, this is the quote that accompanies Varadkar's humble politician of the people pose. The phrase, an island at the centre of the world, is what I particularly want to interrogate here. Undoubtedly, Ireland is an island, but do we think about it? Do we think about its islandness in the same way that we might imagine an island like Sicily or Jamaica? And without even questioning the idea of the centre of the world too much, I think it's necessary to explore some of the reasons why Ireland as an island might be a complex idea. So to do this, I'm going to use research from the fields of island studies as well as Irish studies. And then with these kind of critical comments in mind, look at some poetry at the end of the article. So my approach is framed by Ireland's kind of colonial background, and I suppose in quotation marks it's post-colonial status, that's kind of a contested idea in some ways, not least because David Gleeson argues that, historically speaking, Ireland's prominent position in the Atlantic world was predicated on its relationship to Great Britain. Obviously, the fact that it features at the centre of maps is because Britain is at the centre of traditional maps, so that's also kind of a link there. Ireland's proximity to Britain profoundly affects its relationship to its own islandness. As J.H. Andrew notes, Ireland's inclusion in the expression, quote, British Isles, which has, and I'm still quoting, has been unanimously applied by ancient writers to the two countries taken together. Obviously, unfortunately, the term British also carries political implications. To be an island in the British Isles is somewhat antithetical to the idea of nationhood for an island that wants to be independent from that same colonial power. Furthermore, the island's political status in this regard was kind of cemented by the 1801 Act of Union, in which the island became part of the United Kingdom, Great Britain and Ireland. Andrews continues that Ireland's, quote, size is psychologically diminished by the nearby presence of an island, long thought to be twice as large as itself, and actually about 2.75 times as large. And so it would seem then, when it comes to island studies, size does matter. Within the field, scholars tend to favour small islands, resulting in, as Alison Mount says, quote, less studied large island or archipelago states where islandness may be taken for granted, and she cites Ireland as an example. As Godfrey Baldacchino points out, quote, the fact remains that the metaphoric deployment of island with the associated attributes of small physical size and warm water is possibly the central gripping metaphor within Western discourse. Indeed, Ireland, the second largest island in Europe and 20th in the world, excluding continental Australia, seems to rule it out of the category of smallness, while Ireland's waters, even on the warmest summer day, might be best described as chilly. the deserted island, the tropical island, the exotic island, islands of cannibals, Edenic islands. These are all tropes which were central to both colonial and literary minds during the Age of Empire. Rod Edmund and Vanessa Smith note, quote, "Islands seem to be natural colonies. This is not just because of the desire to possess what is paradisal or utopian, but because islands, unlike continents, look like property," unquote. While the settlement of Ireland was Britain's first foray into island colonisation, or colonisation on a whole, the island itself, quote, nonetheless, quote, suffers some loss of perceived insularity by being easily visible from Britain, unquote, as Andrew says. This colonial relationship has meant the evolution of a complex affiliation to islandness. For Beth Whiteman, the 1985 Anglo-Irish Agreement, which used the term Ireland to refer to the whole island with its political instability, quote, rendered the linguistic and political distinctions between island and Ireland a continuum problem. And for Jerry Smith in Space and the Irish Cultural Imagination, the debates around wholeness of the island are strained. So he kind of outlines the debate quite well, so I'm just going to kind of follow him for a moment. And he notes that for Irish writer Brendan Kiley, early Irish literature, quote, clearly shows the presence of an irrevocable and mystical relationship between dwellers and islands. In Kiley's reading, this mystical relationship embraced the whole island, unquote. However, Smith goes on to note opposition to this from historian James Charles Roy, who, quote, does not share Kiley's understanding, of the special relationship between landscape and people as a vindication of the one island state, unquote, calling the idea, quote, a revisionist history of absolutely no relation to fact, unquote. So the idea that the wholeness of the island is in some way related to the real or imagined past demonstrates that the separation of the island into the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland seems to present some barriers to what constitutes the island of Ireland. And of course, Ireland, the words sound too similar, so. Ireland as an island. Ireland is an island with its own islands. And these islands, as Andrew notes, quote, have had the same fascination for Irishmen as the whole of Ireland has had for foreigners. Indeed, much has been written critically about the status of Ireland's offshore islands. Kristen Morrison argues that in literature, the Irish islands are distinctly, quote, different from Ireland, not really the same country. Conversely, Aidan O'Sullivan argues that Ireland's western islands are, quote, icons of a true Irishness, the dwelling places of a Gaelic people, pure, clean living, and timeless. Many of these threads may also be found in popular considerations of these islands, most notably in Ireland's most quotable series, Father Ted, and this was where the clip was supposed to play of the opening sequence, but unfortunately it's not working, so I'll just let you hopefully know enough about the opening sequence to imagine it. Craigie Island is at once an extreme version of Irishness in a world apart from the realities of living on the so-called mainland. In the opening scene, you'll notice, if you look carefully, a kind of jarring shift of topography from the aerial shots of the island, where you can see the sea from pretty much anywhere, to the surrounds of the parochial house, which is actually located in County Clare, which is all characterised by kind of green hills and sunnier skies. So island or islandness and our understanding of it is created and sustained in part by representations in culture. For Rosadia et al, language plays a significant role in, quote, the sensory and embodied construction of the island for the reader. In Father Ted, the vacillation between the kind of rainbow skies and overcast conditions, as well as the shipwreck on the beach in Craigie Island, render it an unusual space seemingly out of time. In Irish poetry, a changing cultural relationship to the sea can be detected, and I'm particularly interested in the kind of second section, how contemporary poetry might inform our thinking about Ireland as an island. So historically, Ireland was a forceful seafaring nation, and although as noted earlier, tends to define the whole Ireland as united under one ruler, maybe revisionist, there is evidence that the relationship between the sea and the island of Ireland were seen in more holistic terms. For example, this early poem, Storm at Sea, written sometime before the 13th century, begins, "Tempest on the Plain of Lear." The poem views the island as a whole, with every bay in Ireland booming when the flood against it comes. The island's coasts are all connected here, as the poem's bird's eye view presents a connected, holistic view of the island at the mercy of the stormy tides. Yet, as Irish poetry turned inwards to the land and rural spaces, I'm thinking of people like Kavanagh, Montague, and so on, so too did critical attention turn inland. It is worth reconsidering this trope. Ireland's insularity has been, if not the dominant one, at least a concern for contemporary Irish poets. In the last part of my presentation, I'll focus on the work of two canonical poets of the late 20th century, Eleni Quilnon and Seamus Heaney, who you've already heard about. Although not obviously poets of the coast, especially in Heaney's case, who just heard about his interest in the bog and so on, and that's generally how we kind of think of him. Both are writers who think about the idea of the nation, the importance of place and liminal or boundary spaces, and a close examination of their work reveals that a vision of islandness does emerge. So these are just kind of two other collections that might kind of reflect this. A notable but little discussed Heaney poem in this respect is Parable Island from the Hall Lantern, published in 1987. Let me see here. So it begins, although they are an occupied nation and their only border is an inland one, they yield to nobody in their belief that their country is an island. It's easy to see the parallels here between Heaney's Parable Island and his Ireland. The border and occupation seems to disrupt islandness despite the residents' beliefs. For Edna Longley, the poem, quote, turns on language questions, on the endless ways in which an island can be constructed or construed, unquote. Naming becomes central in the poem, but its inadequacy is stressed throughout as the speaker hopes for, quote, the ore of truth in all these names. Similarly, mapping proves to be futile, a craft that does not reflect the realities of the space. Instead, the speaker proposes an openness to the space, a silence which listens for truth. To find out where he stands, the traveller has to keep listening, since there is no maps which draw the line he knows he must have crossed. So again, the border becomes an issue here. Heaney presents almost an undivided view, an island in which its inhabitants and travellers don't actually see a physical border. The island is constructed as a shifting space open to multiple interpretations, rather than a space whereby, quote, subversives and collaborators vie with fierce possessiveness for the right to set the island story straight. The island story, as it would seem, is one which holds these multiplicities, as demonstrated by the playful playful stanzas throughout. Islandness is both and not dependent on wholeness here, but rather it is perspective which seems to weigh the heaviest. The suggestions that there may be a singular truth in all of the opposing views is also cautioned through the implication of the domination of a, quote, one-eyed all-creator, so kind of undercutting that idea of one kind of core truth. And the island of Parable Island is also not Ireland and has links to another famous island poem of Heaney's, the longer poem Station Island, taken from the collection of the same name, published in 1984. The stone circles that he talks about in Parable Island, which to one person are a pure symbol, to another assembly spots or hut foundations, recall the stones of the pilgrimage site at Loch Derg. So pilgrims walk around kind of stone circles thought to be remains of the hut on the island as part of a kind of three-day, fairly grueling pilgrimage. Station Island is one of those islands of Ireland, although it's inland in the middle of Loch Derg. So it's a space that's connected to, but also separate from, the larger island itself. And as such, the poem and the island become a kind of microcosm of Irish literature, as figures such as Joyce and Kavanagh appear to speak to the poet. Station Island is circumscribed in a way that Ireland does not usually appear in Heaney's work. For example, the speaker mentions in section 3, I thought of walking round and round, a space utterly empty, utterly a source, like the idea of sound, or like the absent sense in a swamp-fed air. In this way, the island's presence is revealed in its shape and size and becomes a source of poetic inspiration. Elsewhere, its edges are brought into focus as the speaker describes his encounter with the Loch's water. I had come to the edge of water, soothed by just looking, idling over it as if it were a clean barometer or a mirror. The clearly defined island of this poem is more reassuring to the poet than the divided island of Parable Island, which is underscored by its linguistic instability. Yet at the same time, the return to the so-called mainland seems to bring with it reassurance, perhaps in having completed the pilgrimage, but also in the alien comfort of stepping on firm ground. The island within the island feels an alternate world, and the pilgrim returns revitalized, embracing the mainland with renewed appreciation, but also an uncanny sense of place. Perhaps Ireland's own islandness has been thrown into question after the experience of such an easily circumscribable place. Turning then to Ní Chuilnán's poetry, one poem in particular presents a rarely seen vision of Ireland from a sea-based perspective. In The Last Glimpse of Erin, the island is seen from the perspective of an omniscient speaker who is somehow linked to the swimmer of the poem. So he can see the coastline, a swimmer's polished shoulder heaving on the edge of the sky. Our eyes make it grow, the last glimpse, low and smooth in the sea. The swimmer's body is linked with the shape of the island, and his quote polished shoulder reflects the smooth coastline of the third line. Lines and edges are dominant here as the island's coast defines the space. Despite this rigidity, however, the swimmer is only afforded a last glimpse, suggesting a kind of movement in opposition to the island's stasis. While not anthropomorphized as such, the link between body and land makes the island a kind of living space. The poem and its title could also be read as the lament of the departing emigrant, and as such, the connection with the body might also speak to a feeling of wholeness at home. That quote, our eyes make it grow, unquote, is suggestive of how weight can be placed on a space when considered from afar, both physically here in the sea in this poem, and also metaphorically, if away from Ireland. The third stanza furthers the connection between body and land, adding perhaps a sexual element as a sleeping figure in bed is compared to the swimmer amongst the waves. Ní Chuilnán resists the trope of connecting a female body with the island, which is kind of very much done throughout Irish literature, as the swimmer here is male. But by the final lines, the focus has shifted back to the island space. The island, trimmed with waves, is lost in the sea. The swimmer is lost in his dreams. While the island seemed at the beginning to define itself through edges and surface, the waves now play an important part in cordoning that space. The swimmer's dream may return us to feelings of emigration and loss, a key part of the island's history. And given the dominance of the West Coast in migration to the US, the idea of moving to such a large landmass that is America may also turn the island itself into the thing that is remembered as space is transformed in relation to the much larger location. The final poem I'll look at then is More Islands, also by Ní Chuilnán. Body and islands are again connected as, quote, the child afraid of islands fears their dry, moonlight shoulders. The unknowability and coldness of the island's angular shoulders engenders the fear, but as the child grows, a positive connection with nature is regained, as she, quote, feels the sea in the waves of her hair. With this maturing, she comes to a more comprehensive understanding of islands, all the while recognizing that they may remain unknown to us. She knows there are, quote, some islands the sea avoids. In this poem, islands become a sort of otherworldly space, similar to in Station Island. On these islands, quote, a man shouting for help, a bell ringing, can call over hundreds of high tides, and not be heard, raising no echo. They seem to be the very space of isolation, yet this is kind of denied by the final line, the lines which suggest the first fire lit by a castaway cuts the darkness, liberating silence. In this scenario, the island becomes more like Heaney's Station Island, as it is a space removed in which a freeing silence can be found. It also perhaps has links to English literature's earliest novels, given that Robinson Crusoe could be considered the first castaway of literature. This places Ní Chuilnán's work in dialogue with the literary tradition, but in a more obscure way than Heaney. Her work on islands is more concerned with boundaries, mystery, otherworld, movement and change, suggesting that these are concerns, might be key concerns for Ireland as an island also. So, I don't have to say that anymore. For me, Bradford's confident assertion that Ireland is an island at the centre of the world presents a kind of epistemological challenge. What does being an island mean? What images are associated with ideas of insularity? I think, given some of the questions around Brexit at the moment and the idea of the border, this is the question of islandness has been brought to the fore. Aside from and perhaps before a consideration of Ireland's own position in the world, it is worth questioning its island status. As I hopefully have shown, this is complicated in part by a colonial history and partition, a turn inwards to the country's rural fields and bogs, as well as the presence of offshore islands. In poetry, Heaney and Equilnon pose these questions, presenting shifting meanings of islands, both Ireland itself and its offshore ones, so as to understand the space in a meaningful way. For both islands and Ireland can be seen as a space of reflection, shifting borders experienced through listening and looking attentively, but also connected to larger parts of the world through its literature and position in the sea. The island is no longer an object of colonial possession, but a complex site of culture, nature, and above all, poetry. Thank you very much.